Okay, I think we're in business. So it was an experience for me also to go back and listen to the lecture. I've known for years that I used the terms right and okay and all right many times, but I didn't realize it was as bad as it actually is. But that's part of trying to get you to respond to different things. And then I even heard myself say symbology. I said, what the hell is symbology? That's a study of symbols. It's, you know, symbolism is the word I wanted. But then again, it's my alter ego. You see, I'm really Robert Langdon, right? And the Da Vinci Code. So that's probably where I picked it up and it was floating around in my head someplace and I used symbology, which is not the proper word. But if you're interested in symbology and the Da Vinci Code, if you go to the study aids under the lighter side of organic chemistry, there's a PowerPoint which I think relates the Da Vinci Code, aromaticity, and Bayer, or some sort of combination of things of that sort. And it's more for entertainment purposes, so take a look. All right, so we're going to go with part two of our friend Emil Fischer and the carbohydrates, and I may well cut out parts of, I think we made it up to 24 here. All right, so what we did was we left off, so we need to show here. All right, here we are with our friend glucose, which we know is right over here, and we proved that the other day. And if we rotate about the C5-C4 bond by 120 degrees, and I said think of that in the sense of a Newman projection looking down the C5-C4 bond, and then you get a picture that looks like this. Okay. Now, we have to get rid of that aldehyde group. And what occurs is you get hemiacetal formation. That is, if you have an aldehyde or a ketone, and particularly aldehydes, if you treat them with water, they can hydrate. Formaldehyde that you use in the bio lab, 40% formaldehyde, there's no carbonyl group in that. It's all hydrated, okay? So it loves to hydrate. Now, if you do the same thing with an alcohol and an aldehyde, then you get what's called a hemiacetal. So one half is an OH group and one half is an OR group. A full acetal has to be formed by acid catalysis so that you have OR and OR. So, in principle, any one of these hydroxyl groups could form a ring with the aldehyde. Of course, we're not going to expect a ring to form here, probably not here, because it's four atoms, right? It's a small ring. And because the reaction's reversible, it's going to open. It's not going to stay closed. So, the ideal ones are generally six and five. So, if we look at this oxygen down here, we have one, two, three, four, five. Six atoms away forms a nice six-membered hemiacetal. And a ring that contains an oxygen in it that's six-membered is called a tetrahydropyrane. Well, if it's tetrahydropyrane, then what is pyrene? Well, pyrene is then anything that looks like this or this. Clearly, either of these structures has added 2 moles of hydrogen to give you a tetrahydrocompound. So, any carbohydrate that contains this ring system is called a pyranose. Ose because it's a sugar, and pyrene because it's a six-membered ring. And while we're on the subject, this heterocycle is called furane. And this is tetrahydrofurane, just the same analogy. It's used as a solvent and replace. It's miscible with water in all proportions, unlike diethyl ether, and quite often is used in Grignard reagents. So that if you have any sugar derivative that's a five-membered ring, then it's called a furanose. Okay. So this is the way Fisher drew the pictures originally. Now, this long, ugly bond that I mentioned the other day is not really a bond, all right? It just shows you that that oxygen is connected to that carbon. But when you do that reaction, you create a new asymmetric center, because at C1, you have an OH group, you have this thing, you have the oxygen, and you have the H. So if there's no control of stereochemistry at that new center, you get a mixture. And that mixture generally can be dynamic. You can have an equilibration back and forth, back and forth. Okay, so beta D. So this is called a pyranose. This is glucopyranose. If you're talking generically, it's a glycopyranose. But we know the exact structure, so it's a glucopyranose. We know that this oxygen is on the right side, so it's in the D series. And as it turns out, it's dextrorotatory. So we've always been showing the picture looking more like this in the aldehyde form, but it doesn't really exist that way. It exists this way. And when you look at the Fischer projection, that OH group is on the left, and that's called a beta D-glucose. Right? So you've added a new asymmetric center that you have to define. And if it appears on the right, then it's called alpha. And these are separate compounds. You can crystallize them separately. They have different melting points, different rotations. And then if you put them in aqueous solution, they then call what... we call what is mutarotation, so that the hemiacetal opens, goes to the open aldehyde, now it goes, alpha goes to beta goes to alpha, until it reaches some equilibrium position. Okay? And we'll show you how you can separate them. Now, we go on to a much later picture that you'll see in a lot of your biology books, which is still pretty antiquated. It's called the Haworth projection. Now, you've studied cyclohexane probably, right? Knowing that it prefers to be in a chair, conformation. Surprise, surprise. So does a pyrene ring like to be in a chair, conformation. But this was before people knew about chair conformations. So what was done was you normally would draw the ring flat and then put OH up and OH down and OH up and OH down. They look axial, but they're not meant to be axial. Okay. It just shows you the relative configuration. So you could work out the R and S configuration of that with no problem. And here we are. Here's beta D plus glucopyranose, again drawn in a Haworth projection. And the only difference between these two is this center here and that center over there. And now the beta configuration has the OH on the top of the ring, or up if you will. And the alpha configuration has it down or on the bottom. And you will see in a moment there's a reason why I'm using a red arrow and a green arrow. Now, chair conformations. This looks a lot better, all right? You can tell something about glucose. And glucose, as it turns out, likes to have everything equatorial, save possibly that anomeric center. This is called the anomeric center, where the hemiacetal forms. So you have C6 as being an equatorial group, OH group being equatorial, OH here being equatorial, OH here being equatorial, OH here being equatorial. And this is the general way that it's drawn by convention. You draw this kind of a cyclohexane, and you put the oxygen at that position, and then you fill in everything from there. So if you start with that picture in mind, and you see a sugar in a textbook, you can start with glucose, and let's say this configuration is the opposite way around, where the OH group is axial. So that carbon then is 1, 2, 3, 4, and we look at glucose. If we know this is the structure, we can easily look at our chart. What's the C4 epimer of D-glucose? Can you see it there? So move this over here, and you get what? Galactose, right here. Okay? So if you saw that picture, if you have this in mind, then you can figure out what an isomer would be. And here we have the same arrangement as the Haworth projection. Up or on top is beta, and down bottom is the alpha configuration. How an old salt remembers. Now, I told you the other day that I use a lot of mnemonic devices for your benefit and particularly for mine. And I can never remember it. I mean, I don't work on carbohydrates, or I didn't work on carbohydrates that much. And when the spring came around, I had to say, okay, this one's up, this one's not, you know. So you could remember. Anybody know what that is? No, it's not a light bulb. What is an old salt? Anyone know what an old salt is? A sailor, right? Any yachtsmen in the group? All right. Here's one of Ziegler's ingenious mnemonic devices. What is the port side of a ship? See, this is the bow, this is the stern. That's the left side, yeah, because I have port on the left side. Very good, very good. All right? And the starboard is on the right side. Left and right. And the red light is on the left side of the ship, and the green light is on the right side. So if you're looking at a boat or an airplane coming in, and you see the green on the left, you know it's coming towards you, right? If you see the green on the right, you know it's going away from you. All right, fewer letters. So port, left, and red all have fewer letters in them than their counterparts on the right side, starboard, right, and green. Okay? And beta has fewer letters than alpha. And up has fewer letters than down. And top has fewer letters than bottom. How lucky can you get, right? All right, uterotation of anomers. So we have beta D plus glucopyranose. And if it's in solution, they're in equilibrium with one another. If you take a solution of glucose and saturate it and raise the temperature above 98 degrees, so you need a pretty saturated solution to get the temperature up over 100. So it's basically saturated boiling aqueous solution of glucose, which is probably higher than 100 degrees. And if you cool that and allow it to crystallize, out comes the pure beta enantiomer, melting point 150 degrees, and rotation plus 18 of 0.7. If you do the same crystallization at a lower temperature, which means probably use a less concentrated solution but cool it in a freezer or something of that sort, now you get the alpha anomer prefers to crystallize out. And that has a positive rotation of 112.2. So they have different melting points. They have different properties. Okay, and it can be isolated separately. Now, if you place either one in water, you get an equilibrium mixture, which is plus 52.6. And you can calculate this very easily by mole fractions to take this value and find out that at equilibrium, in solution, it's about 64.32 beta over alpha. And here's a list of some hexoses. You don't have to memorize all of this stuff. I mean, it's unimportant. As we said, glucose is... glucose prefers to be in the purinose form, as most sugars do. Some of them like to be in the furanose form. But that's at equilibrium. Okay. So, for instance, in the case of glucose, it's virtually 100% of the purinose form and less than 1% of the furanose form. And of the purinose forms, the beta dominates over the alpha. Now, this is another interesting one down here, and that is fructose, which is a 2-ketose. So fructose will have the same bottom . We're going to see many of the, a little later, we're going to see fructose in the furanose form, a five-membered ring. But you can see here, when it's underivatized, it likes to be in the pyranose form. So, which means it's this oxygen which is hydrating this carbonyl to make a six-membered ring. Okay, so I know you've heard something about periodic acid because I asked Professor McBride about it, whether he mentioned it. He said, in passing. Okay? So in 1927, a French chemist by the name of Malaprade, or maybe it was 1928, I can't remember. Discovered the reaction of periodic acid with 1,2-diols. Now, we won't go through the mechanism of this except to say it forms a cyclic species and then you push your electrons around and you get a 2-electron oxidation. So if you treat this ethylene glycol with periodic acid, in essence what happens is you get 2 moles of formaldehyde formed. Okay? This familiar to you? Yeah? Okay, good. Now, that means we can zip right through this. If you did the same thing with glycerol, then you would cleave the bond here with periodic acid. You get formaldehyde to give you this thing. Well, now it's no longer a 1,2-diol, except for the fact that the aldehyde hydrates in water. Okay? So this aldehyde group now, probably got it here somewhere, undergoes cleavage to give formaldehyde and formic acid. The formic acid being derived from this aldehyde group and the formaldehyde from this piece. And I think we've got that. So that aldehyde hydrates. Well, what does periodic acid know? It looks like a 1,2-diol. 1,2-diol. And when you do that cleavage, clearly you wind up getting formic acid. Because formic acid is nothing more than formaldehyde where you've inserted an O in the CH bond. Well, that's what you've essentially done here by doing the hydration. Formaldehyde always arises in one of these cleavages when we're doing carbohydrates from a primary alcohol. Formic acid arises from the secondary alcohol. Now, let's say we have a sugar. This one is right here, D-glyceraldehyde. If you do periodic acid oxidation of this sugar, this is winds up being hydrated. So this yields formic acid. This one now becomes an aldehyde. It gets hydrated. It yields formic acid. And the bottom guy leads to formaldehyde. So you can tell by the products that are formed what the structure of the sugar is. And let's look at this as typical dihydroxyacetone, 1,3. Let's look at that as a model for for this compound, meaning fructose. So when you do that oxidation, you get formaldehyde and a carboxylic acid, not an aldehyde, right? Because this is already oxidized. And now when you do the cleavage of that compound, you wind up with CO2 and formaldehyde. So CO2 arises from a ketone. So if you have a ketose, you'll always get CO2. If you have an aldose, you'll always wind up getting formic acid from that. So the bottom line is primary alcohol leads to formaldehyde, secondary alcohol leads to formic acid, aldehyde also leads to formic acid, and the ketone group leads to carbon dioxide. So let's look at D-glucose, formic acid, formaldehyde. Right? So you get 5 moles of formic acid and 1 mole of formaldehyde. If we take a reduced compound, so the aldehyde is reduced to an alcohol, and this happens to be the C2 epimer D-mannitol. You get formaldehyde, formic acid, formic acid, formic acid, formaldehyde. So you do the math, right? This molecule is more oxidized than this one by 2 electrons, and so are all the products, because you see all of this stuff down here matches the bottom, and formic acid is 2 electrons higher than formaldehyde in oxidation level. There's a lot of information to be gleaned from that. And then fructose would give formaldehyde, CO2, formic acid, and formaldehyde. Now, let's talk about the methylation of pyranosides because, well, that's incorrect. Well, no, it should be methylation of pyranoses. Because a pyranoside means there's an R group, an OR group at that position. Whether that's a simple alcohol like methanol or something as complicated as cholesterol. So in nature, many natural compounds, digitalis is a steroid that's in foxglove, it's got sugars stuck onto it, it's called a glycoside. And when you chop off all the sugars by hydrolysis and you're left, let's say, with the steroid, that's called the aglycone, meaning it's not a sugar. So here I've simply drawn glucose as a mixture of its alpha and beta anomers. So needless to say, when you take a hemiacetal and you treat it with methanol in the presence of acid, you wind up with esterification or acetal formation at this position. And why there and not anywhere else? Well, the mechanism of this reaction involves protonation at this oxygen, loss of water, and a secondary carbocation. But that carbocation is highly stabilized by the electron pair on this oxygen. So that's a very easy bond to break. Okay? And now if you use a large excess of methanol, that methanol then will form the acetal. Whereas, if you were to protonate any of these guys, if you protonated this and expected some E1 process to go on, you'd have to form a primary alcohol. Not so good. Okay? I mean, you could do it under brutal conditions. You know, sulfuric acid and heat the heck out of it. But this is pretty subtle. You know, drop of HCl and methanol or paratoluene sulfonic acid room temperature will do the job. Right, and clearly the secondary alcohols don't want to give secondary carbocations. Now, what you can do is treat the pyranoside, in this case it's a glucoside mixture, with dimethyl sulfate and sodium hydroxide. So dimethyl sulfate is quite a toxic compound. It's a powerful methylating agent. And hydroxide will simply, this is in water, hydroxide will deprotonate the alcohol in an equilibrium reaction, and those alkoxy groups will do SN2 displacements on dimethyl sulfate to do a methylation. You're doing, what kind of a reaction is it? What's the name of it? You know that? The SN2 formation of ethers from alcohols and halides? Aha! The Williamson ether synthesis, right? As Casey Stengel used to say, you can look it up. But that's what it is, all right? Who's Casey Stengel? Now, the reason that this reaction is not generally done directly to methylate everything using this is because if you make this anion, this can open, and then you start doing your pimerizations, and you get enediols, and you make fructose. So it's always safer to block this position first with methanol and acid before you do the methylation. Whoop, go away. Help. I think I did this the other day. There it goes. Ooh, now we've got to get rid of that. Is that okay? I have to find the arrow. I think we're back in business here. All right. So here we go. We get a permethylated. Per just means everything is has methyl groups on it. And another way to do this reaction is under milder conditions, which is with methyl iodide and silver oxide, which acts as a base. So the silver acts to coordinate with the iodine, stretching out the methyl iodide bond, and that makes the methyl iodide a better electrophile, which means that the alcohol itself can actually act as a nucleophile to displace on the methyl group, and you'd get a precipitated methyl iodide. And now, if you treat the permethylated compound with aqueous acid, you reverse the original reaction that we did here. So, by mass action, we've converted this OH group to a methyl ether, and using mass action once again, doing the reaction in aqueous acid, we can convert that to the corresponding sugar. All right. So, the ring size of pyranosides, I'll just do this very quickly. If you take this compound and you oxidize the bejeebers out of it, meaning oxidize this thing, the aldehyde to a carboxylic acid, and that alcohol, winds up becoming a ketone. Now you have a structure like this. Well, pour it on. Keep going as far as you can. Right? So ethers do not oxidize. But we know that under acidic conditions, ketones undergo enolization. That is, you protonate on this carbonyl group and you lose this proton, you get double bond here, or you protonate at this position, lose that proton, get a double bond there. Both of those events occur. And what happens when you enolize in this direction, you digest this single bond completely. So you get this to become a carboxylic acid group. So this is alpha methoxy acetic acid. And this carbon becomes a carboxylic group. That means this becomes a carbonyl group. This methyl ester winds up becoming a carboxylic acid when you're finished. And what you get out of that reaction is this tartaric acid derivative. And the tartaric acids are known, which one's D and which one's L. This is, of what series is this tartaric acid? This is an aldaric acid, right? And it must be, where is it? Did I put too many lines here? What is this here? That doesn't belong here. So this is, if this is a carboxylic acid, and that's a carboxylic acid from threose, then this is D, capital D, tartaric acid. Okay? So that's the L, capital L compound, because it's a mirror image. And when you get enolization in this direction, then this carbon becomes a carboxylic acid, and you get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbon compound that has this structure, and that one is related to this guy. So this one is what? What's its name, the sugar? Xylose, right. So it's a xylaric acid in the D series. So that's the way the size of the ring was proved. Let me see what else we have here. I want to move through some of this. You can look at a lot of this stuff yourself. Okay, let's go on to some enzymatic cleavages. Okay? So, this is a methyl alpha D glucose side because the O-methyl is on the bottom side. If you put this in the presence of the enzyme, maltase, you can get hydrolysis of that acetal chain to give this anomer the alpha D glucose. Alpha down, got more letters than up, right? And if you use the enzyme amylsin, then you can take a beta D glucoside and convert it to beta D glucose. So each enzyme is specific for the stereochemistry at the glycoside bond. And of course, if you treat either one with aqueous acid, you're going to get a mixture of the two. Okay? Now, there's one other test that's useful to know about, and that's the reaction of glucosides, or the non-reaction of glucosides. If you take methyl D glucoside with a reagent called Collins reagent, which is really just silver ammonium hydroxide, silver ion is an oxidizing agent. Base does not react with acetals, and so there's no reaction. You put that in, you just shake it up, and no heat, no nothing going on. Non-reducing sugar. So this is called a non-reducing sugar. However, if we take D-glucose and we do the same reaction, we get oxidation of this mast aldehyde to a carboxylic acid. We don't isolate that. What else goes on? I don't know. It may keep going and do other things. But what's important is to do a two-electron oxidation on the aldehyde, you have to convert silver plus one to silver zero. Right? So you get two silvers. There should be two in the front here. And what you get is a coating in the test tube of silver. So it's the silver mirror test. So if you have a positive Collins test, that means that you do not have a glycoside, but you have an open masked aldehyde group, because the aldehyde can oxidize. Now, here's beta D fructofuranose. And it's in equilibrium with the pyranose form, which I mentioned earlier. It's slight equilibrium to the ketone. And now we know about imidiols. Remember earlier we said about isomerizing in acids condition from a keto alcohol or an aldehydo alcohol to the imidiol. Well, you can do the same thing in base. All right, so you get the imidiol. That thing can reprotonate. It doesn't know where it came from. Generates, in this particular case, probably glucose and mannose. And then that can undergo the Silvermira test. So a ketose is also a reducing sugar. All right, so we'll go through these in a moment. So a disaccharide is a common name for two sugars hooked together. An oligosaccharide, O-L-I-G-O, is from the Greek meaning a few. So it's usually up to eight, anything greater than two and up to eight. And then after that, they're sort of called polysaccharides. So alpha-D-glucopyranosyl beta-D-fructofuranoside. So when you go home for the summer and you say to your mother or father, would you be kind enough to pass me the NaCl? That, and they knew what that was if, you know, when you were in high school. Oh, that's salt. But when you tell them, pass me the alpha-D glucopyranosyl beta-D fructofuranoside, say what? Right? Say what? Sucrose. So here's the glucose part. It's got an alpha linkage to the glucose, right? But a beta linkage to the fructose. So is this, well, I was going to ask you, this is non-reducing sugar. There's the answer. It's non-reducing because it's a full acetal. Now, the question you might ask yourself, is it truly a carbohydrate? Because its formula is C12H22O11, which comes out to N minus 1 waters. Okay, so it's two molecules of a mono sugar minus a mole of water. Okay, they're sugars. Okay. Or you can turn it around and do it the other way if you really want to fake them out. Right? Use this, the fructose as the adjective and use the glucose as the noun. So there you have an acetal and you have a ketal. Nowadays they tend to call all these linkages acetals. I like to use the older nomenclature because it distinguishes an aldehyde, right, from a ketone. And you can clearly see this is a mass ketone because two oxygens is worth a carbonyl. Carbon on this side, carbon on that side. Here's an H and a carbon, so that's an aldehyde. And what are the things that they make from sugar? Well, if you acylate this whole thing with carboxylic acids from the range of 6 to 8, you make olestra. Remember olestra? I don't even know if they use it anymore. But as a fake fat, all right? So fats are derivatives of glycerol, which have stearic acid on them. So you got this an ester with a big fatty chain, so this is sort of a way to make it. But people had a lot of problems with their bathroom problems, let's say, after eating things with olestra in it. So this brings to interest, so you can read this. Now, let me tell you about Professor Harry Wasserman. He was a professor of organic chemistry here, an accomplished jazz clarinetist, and an accomplished artist, because you probably have seen his work at, what is it called, the Yale Bookstore? I don't know what the name is. Barnes & Noble runs it, or, yeah, it keeps changing its name. If you go in the back at the cafeteria, right, or make a point of going back to the end of the bookstore, and up there are paintings of all these different Yale buildings, they're all his watercolors. The only department is the chemistry department picture. Everything else is Harkness or something of that sort. All right? And he was an undergraduate at Harvard in the 1940s. He was called into the armed services. He was in the chemical warfare division in North Africa in the 1940s. But he went back to Harvard to work with a young hotshot by the name of R.B. Woodward, who you're going to learn about in Friday's lecture from Professor McBride. And here's a story that he told. So this discussion brings to mind a wonderful story told to me by Professor Wasserman, who during the late 1940s was a graduate student of R.B. Woodward. Apparently Woodward had received the notice of a $1,000 prize for the first person to accomplish the chemical synthesis of sucrose. Why you would want to do that other than it's like mountain climbing? I mean, the world is full of sucrose, right? It's the largest, purest compound produced from nature. But in any case, he went into the laboratory and said to his students that all they had to do was connect two molecules of glucose together, lose a molecule of water, and they'd have themselves $1,000. One student, obviously not overwhelmed by Woodward's stature in the field, even at such a young age, replied that if you did it that way, it'd be $2,000. Why? Because sucrose is not two molecules of glucose. It's a molecule of glucose and a molecule of fructose. So this is the reverse of the first prize, 1 week in Philadelphia, second prize, 2 weeks in Philadelphia. Sucralose, yet another sweetening agent. This is a little tougher. Right? So I'm not going to bother going through that. Now, here is sucrose, non-reducing sugar. Here is sucralose, 600 times sweeter than sugar, than sucrose. Now, I don't know how they do these tests. I guess they probably have a panel and, you know, and they ask somebody, how many times sweet do you think it is? Twice. A million, right? They average the numbers. They get 600. I'm not quite sure how they do this. But what differences do you see here in these two structures? So, sucralose has three chlorine atoms in it. Right? Now, this thing is a sweetening agent, but it's not metabolized. So, it just goes through. Just like sorbitol. Sorbitol is the reduction product of D-glucose. It would seem logical that it is called glucitol, but there is a natural material called sorbitol, which is exactly the same. Okay? And that also is not metabolized, but it's sweet. Now, one thing we notice is that this chlorine is primary, that chlorine is primary, that one is not touched. And what about this? What sugar is this? If that chlorine were an OH. Yeah, that's why I mentioned that before, the C4 epimer. So it's interesting what's going on here. I'm not going to go through all the chemistry of it, but this primary alcohol and that primary alcohol and that primary alcohol are protected by a very bulky reagent called trityl chloride. So you have three phenyl rings. So you can certainly imagine that this thing is going to ionize fairly readily, right? Because you're going to have a carbon with three phenyl rings stabilizing all that charge. Okay? And so by an E1 process, you substitute this position and you substitute that position. All right? Now, follow me. Now you're going to treat this with acetic anhydride and make an acetate ester here, one here, one here, one here, one here, and one here. So you have two trityls and, what, about five or six acetates. Now we're going to hydrolyze off the trityl groups, the triphenyl methyls, in acid. Under conditions which take the trityl groups off, right, but do not take the acetates off. So we can free this position and free this position, and we have all these acetates. But once we free this one, the acetate that's here migrates to this position, onto that oxygen. So basically, you've done Fischer esterification, right? Yes, no, right? So you know the mechanism of that reaction. You take carboxylic acid, propionate, methanol ends, blah, blah, blah. If you take a methyl ester and you put it in ethanol and acid, right? Then it goes the other way. You become an ethyl ester and you lose methanol. This is just an intramolecular version of that. So what happens is you now wind up with acetate here. This is free. Acetate, acetate, free. Acetate, acetate, free. Now you make tosylate, know that one? Sulfonate, right? To activate this position, to activate this position, and to activate that position. Now you treat it with chloride. And you do an SN2 reaction. Chlorine winds up here, chlorine winds up here. And this goes from a gluco configuration to a galacto configuration by virtue of the SN2 mechanism. All right, bees do it, right? They take sucrose and use the enzyme invertase to generate glucose plus fructose. The original, high fructose corn syrup, right? Because high fructose corn syrup is usually about 55-45 fructose to glucose, and that is made enzymatically. So if you eat honey, you're eating high fructose corn syrup. All right, we are... all right, I think it's probably time to... All right, so let's talk briefly about, I don't want to do all of these things, but all the information that I gave you earlier about methylation that is used in the determination of the structure of these kinds of carbohydrates. So this is cellulose, polysaccharide, present in plants all over the place. You can't eat it because you cannot cleave beta linkages. All right? Cows do a good job of it because they have bacteria in their guts that undergo this cleavage and reduce it to glucose, and then they metabolize it. Partial hydrolysis of a polysaccharide gives cellobiose, which is this disaccharide. This is a reducing sugar only by virtue of that terminal group, right? But none of these are reducing sugars. And this gives you just some information on this. Let me put the whole thing up and... Oops. Hydrolysis in acid gives D-glucose. Emulsin cleaves the beta glucoside, would also give 2 moles of D-glucose. Positive tolerance reaction shows mutor rotation. Why does it show mutor rotation? Because it's beta configuration. If you put it into an aqueous solutions, you'll get alpha and beta anomers being formed. Bromine water clearly oxidizes the terminal end of the glucose molecule, just like it does in simple systems. When you permethylate, you block all the hydroxyl groups. And now when you do a hydrolysis, this chunk here becomes a carboxylic acid. This chunk here becomes an aldehyde with all these methoxies. This free OH shows you that it was linked that way. And this one shows you it was the leader in the chain, that it was the carboxyl end, the reducing end. The carboxylic acid is on the right side. Okay. So this is the kind of information they use to determine the structure of these types of sugars. And I'm not going to go through all of this. You can... Maltose. The only difference between cellobiose, the disaccharide, and its beta linkage is this one with the alpha linkage. And this you can metabolize. Maltase cleaves it. All right, lactose, lactose intolerance. See, galactose is a glucose on this end and a galactose on the backside. Right, C4 epimer. And some folks have trouble metabolizing, doing this metabolic procedure. So lactate contains lactase to pre-cleave the disaccharide. And amygdalin, okay, so don't run away. The best part is yet to come. This is a compound called Laetrile, which was touted to be a cancer cure. It's not, okay? But the structure, the chemistry of this was done by Vohler, and you're going to learn about the benzoin condensation because I looked it up. It's on the next thing, right? Next lecture on Wednesday. And I want you to be really smart, so he probably won't see this. So what they did was Vohler hydrolyzed this and got the sugars. And notice that this is a normal beta anomer, but this is connected to C6, not to C4 like most things are. And then this hydroxyl is the cyanohydrin of benzaldehyde. So if you hydrolyze this compound, you get 2 moles of glucose, you get HCN and benzaldehyde. And if you put it in base, you do the benzoin condensation. So when he starts in with the benzoin condensation, I want you to raise your hand and say, Professor McBride, would this work on the benzoin condensation have any... thing to do with Wohler's early work on the structure of amygdalin, you know. All right. Starches, you can read this. All right. And finally, a true story. In March of 1986, I was out on the West Coast giving some lectures during spring break. And I had been loaned a bicycle by my wife's cousin, which was all rusty. And he said, drive down to the beach in San Diego. So I get on the bike, I hit the brake, I fall off. So by the time I get to Stanford, my foot is swollen, and I'm having some trouble walking. So I go into the, instead of going to some nice, elegant lunch, I go to the health center there. And so the young resident is there. So I asked him to find out something about his background. So it turns out he went to MIT. So I said, well, you must have had Professor Kemp. He wrote a textbook, you know. He said, yes, as a matter of fact, I did. I said, well, tell me, will you, what D-aldohexose forms the same ozone as glucose? Now, like Diogenes the Cynic, in search of an honest man, I have posed this question to many a practitioner of the medical and dental professions. Neither Diogenes nor I have fulfilled our quests. However, the responses to my queries were often amusing. I really enjoyed organic chemistry. Really. All right? Organic chemistry, don't remind me. An honest man. I know the mechanism of the Eldol condensation. Watch out. I know what a Grignard reagent is. Wrong test. Wait, give me some time. It's only an hour exam. Okay? Now, I will say one thing about this. I came across a radiologist down at the Yale facility, and I was chatting with her, and I said, so where were you an undergraduate? She said, oh, here at Yale. I said, oh, and who'd you take organic chemistry with? You know, the old guy with the white hair? I said, he's not so old. He's actually younger than I am, but I think you mean Professor McBride. He said, yeah, that was his name. So I said, what's your answer to the question? She said, fructose. I said, you're about as close as anyone. It does indeed form the same ozone, but it's not an aldose, it's a ketose. Whatever. Okay. So there's a good connection there. So we brought it back to this class. And the moral of this story is, somewhere, sometime, someone might ask you this. What D-aldohexose forms the same ozone as D-glucose? And you will respond? D-mannose. Not L-mannose. Will be the mirror image. You will answer D-mannose. We're out of here. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.